This is North Fork Works, where you're about to meet Stephanie Gaylor, a farmer who specializes in collecting, growing, and breeding heirloom seeds and vegetables. I'm sitting with her in the farmhouse after she showed me around her fields, where I saw thousands of tomato plants as well as many other crops. Before she settled into farming, Steph was a librarian at Stony Brook with a special interest in historiography. She's in the process of house hunting right now, but spends more time than most of us with her hands deep in North Fork soil, digging and planting and harvesting and collecting seeds from the thousands of plants on the 2 acres she leases from the Peconic Land Trust in Southold. Welcome to North Fork Works, Steph.
Thank you.
So introduce us to your farm. What's it called?
It's called Invincible Summer Farms, after an Albert Camus quote that says something to the effect of, in the depths of my deepest winter, I find there lay in me an invincible summer. Which means no matter how bad things are, you're always going to have a spring and you're always going to have a summer. So it's about resiliency.
I'm a little bit confused, ignorant, about some of the terminology.
Mm-hmm.
So are the thousand vegetables, are those all different varieties, or are tomatoes one variety and corn is another variety?
No,
what is the taxonomy?
The taxonomy is there's 1,000 varietals within the tomato family. It's not even the tomato family. It's called the nightshade family. There's tomatoes, there's peppers, there's eggplant. Within the cucurbits family, there is melons, summer squash, winter squash, cucumbers, and a bunch of other things. But what I'm specifically talking about is varietals. So we do the 350 plus different types of tomatoes, 32 different kinds of winter squash, 20 some odd summer squash, 20 some odd corn varieties. It goes down the list. So that's what I mean by 1,000 different varieties.
So let's start with a question I'm most curious about. Why are you so interested in seeds? And how long ago did what you've told me is your obsession with tomatoes, how long ago did that begin? And is everything you do heirloom varieties, and what does that mean?
Okay, so my tomato obsession began about a decade ago. I became very interested in tomatoes. It seems like once you got into it, there were more and more. Overall, there's probably about 10 to 12,000 different tomato varieties. And the interesting thing about the importance of seed saving is to increase the genetic pool and the genetic choices that we have in terms of our food. The difference between an heirloom versus an open pollinated versus a hybrid is an heirloom. There's 4 different types of heirlooms. There's something called a family heirloom, which is passed down through generations. It's been in that family or that particular region, or those people on that particular block save that kind of seed. There's a commercial heirloom. Heinz is a good example. They used to breed their own tomatoes. So now there's like Heinz 309 tomato. Once it's over 50 years old, it's considered an heirloom. And then there's created heirlooms, which are bred varieties. Like a Green Zebra is relatively new. Tom Wagner bred that in the 70s. Now it's considered an heirloom, even though it's relatively new. And then there's the kind of mystery heirlooms that nobody knows really where they came from. But it's kind of like a oops in the pollination, and then people just kept saving it. So those are the different types of heirloom. And open pollinated is more, it's not isolated. It's more likely to breed. You want it to be a regionally adapted variety. That's the best way I can describe an open pollinated. And a hybrid is something that is usually patented by a company. They hold a patent on it. They hold the technology. They're very secretive about how they bred these two things together to create this first generation. And although you could save the seeds for it, it's not going to breed true to what you originally had planted. So that's the best short answer I can give you.
I know you have worked in a librarian capacity, whatever the actual title.
In a library.
At Stony Brook.
Right.
And your interest in historiography, is that just an academic, graduated in that?
Or? I did graduate work in history and historiography in particular, and I was very interested in food historiography and the way of telling the story in terms of food. And historiography is essentially the way of telling history. There are different ways of telling the same story. There's no grand narrative.
I'd like to weave together these three, what I see, strands of your life. You may see it completely differently, but the historiography, the sort of librarian work, the work in a library, and your interest in, I don't know, is it agriculture?
It's not,
seeds in particular. How do they come all together?
Right. Well, I mean, the congruence or the confluence of these three different things is working in a library, you have to be very detail oriented and everything has its place. It's very scientific and it's very well documented, or it should be. So, I mean, I like ways of putting data together to make a system more efficient and to get the most amount of information you can out of a set of data. And also with history is you could watch a pattern in history. You could remove yourself emotionally because history becomes very emotional and it can be very opinionated. If you could remove yourself from that, you can watch mechanisms of things at play in history. So those two things, you know, working in a library, looking at history, and also looking at plants and what people are planting, why we use this particular food, they're all very well matched towards each other. Because what started me off, even with the tomatoes, was I was thinking, well, how come they don't offer this tomato? I mean, first I was only growing hybrids way back when.
When was way back when?
In college. So I was growing hybrids, you know, in my apartment, and they would have all these great varieties, and they were Ice Queen and this and that and the other thing. And
I'm sorry, were they hybrids that you created?
No, they were hybrids from the seed company. Okay. So, but they never tasted great. So you would get lulled into all these, you know, magical descriptions of the tomato plant. And I was wondering, well, why are only some seeds being offered? And then once I got into heirlooms and breeding my own varieties, I found there was a huge wealth, like millions, basically, of varieties across the board of different kinds of crops that were not even close to growing. There's a very small set, and I realized this, a very small set of seeds that gardeners plant, and it's because of the choices that they have. And I was kind of interested in why that story is that particular way, when 50 years ago, people had many, many more choices as to what they were growing.
And so what was your answer to that?
Well, I think even 50 years ago, people would, you know, say, I got this seed from my uncle. They would trade it with their neighbors. Everybody had gardens, or many, many people had gardens. It was just what your grandparents did. They had a garden in the summertime. They picked their own beans. They grew their own tomatoes. That has largely been lost, primarily after the 50s in the advent of all this industrialized food culture where everything got much faster and much more efficient. So a lot of that has been lost, even with farmers. Farmers used to save their own seeds. They were not buying seeds from major seed corporations. And I mean the top six seed corporations, Monsanto, Seminis, Syngenta, Bayer. So now farmers are not saving their seeds anymore. So the choices that you have are greatly reduced to what a company thinks would be better. And usually that's very much rooted in agrochemical technology, whether it's GMO or, you know, a hybrid. They're not really offering heirloom seeds or open pollinated.
So do you actually think of yourself as a farmer or as more of a researcher, a historian? Do you collect other things?
Oh, yes. Other than seeds, I collect turn of the century, very old seed catalogs, which really ties into the history. And it's really terribly interesting to me because there's a one seed catalog I got, a Henderson catalog from 1901. And you see the kind of seeds that they were breeding. It's a New York company, but the front of the catalog, you're on the Hudson and you're looking into New York City. They have a steamboat with a paddle wheel in the back. You can see the Statue of Liberty and sailboats. So that is a slice of a picture of history at that particular time. If when I look through that catalog, I could see what they were growing. It's just an amazing historical document, these seed catalogs. So that is something that I've really amassed a considerable collection of. I'm in the process of digitizing it, you know, in the off season, because it's a tremendous resource in terms of history and what we're growing.
Do seeds last forever? I mean, this idea of saving seeds.
Seeds have a finite life. I think there's ways, there's tricks. You know, you can get a 20-year-old tomato seed and use various chemical tricks to try to wake it up. But they have a very finite life. You can't keep them forever unless you're the Doomsday Vault in, I believe it's Greenland.
So how long do they, like 2 years, 5 years?
Tomato seeds can last, like I would say 7. Pepper seeds much less, maybe 2 to 3.
I see.
You know, it varies. You have to really know what you're growing.
Okay, so talk now a little bit about the fields themselves. We've just come in from looking at them. Just explain to our listeners how it's all laid out. It's 2 acres of land.
The entire field is mapped out with accession numbers, which translate into the names of what it is. So we label everything with an accession number rather than labeling it with the name. And then the field is mapped out with those accession numbers so we can find what we're looking for at any given time.
And
so,
why not the name?
Well, it's not a really good system. And plus the fact we want, I would prefer it be a blind numerical system where you're looking at something and you have no preconceived notions of what you're looking at.
But there is a name somewhere.
Oh, absolutely.
In your database, Everything has a name.
It's what's going on in the field is basically like a Dewey Decimal System for my plants.
Do you take notes when you're going up and down these rows?
Yes. Every day I basically choose one particular crop that I'm going to discuss. And as I'm going down the row, I'll name characteristics, what they're segregating as, if they're bred plants, what they look like, are they holding up good against pests, are they being taken down by any kind of diseases.
So you're writing it down?
Oh no, it's on a voice recorder on my iPhone.
So did you do any of that today, for instance?
Yes, and then I have to go back out after this and do that again for the tomatoes.
Just as an example, what notes did you make today on about what?
Basically, I'm working on breeding type of winter squash. So I got seeds from Ken Ettlinger, and these types are segregating out. But then I also did my own cross of two types that I really wanted, which is Thelma Sandra sweet potato, which is very prolific, and one from France, because I want to breed the taste into the Thelma Sanders. And the Thelma Sanders has done really well in terms of disease resistance and not really being affected by pests, where other types have just gone down. So those are the kinds of things that I'm going to mention when I'm going through the field. I'll say, you know, type XYZ has been, you know, completely eviscerated by beetles or squash bugs, whereas this type has held up well. Notes like that. So next year I could say, well, this, you know, I tried all these different varieties. This one did really well and this one didn't.
So does that mean it's unpredictable?
Initially, yes, it's unpredictable. And it's kind of like, for me, it's every day is Christmas because you really don't know what you're going to find out there. And it's really interesting to find cross-pollinated tomato plants that are throwing out like 6 different kinds of fruits.
On one plant?
Not on one plant, but in one row. Exactly. So somebody took the fruit from that cross-pollinated plant, like they, let's say, for example, they bred a Cherokee Purple and a Matt's Wild Cherry. So then that first year with those fruits that they saved, I'm going to plant like 20 plants or 30 plants, and I'm going to see all different types of fruit from that. And it's just, that's really interesting to see what comes out of that.
So success is when it is predictable.
Then it is predictable.
Yeah. I've sometimes seen when odd-shaped vegetables in the market, the farm stands and so on. And I just always thought, oh, well, it's just a sort of the marketing novelty and, you know, just to sort of amuse the consumer. And I didn't really take them very seriously. But obviously you have a very different view of basically what is diversity. That seems to underlie your entire mission. This is Hazel Kahn and North Fork Works. I'm sitting with Steph Gaylor, Southold farmer, who's talking about her work collecting and breeding heirloom seeds and vegetables.
Seed diversity is paramount to our food security. As evidenced by the Irish famine and the potatoes, they had one kind of potato and that was basically taken down by late blight. So I think in this particular climate, with climate change and with all these, you know, changing variables with farming, we can't really rely on one monocrop, which we are. I read someplace that basically the only green bean that's available to American consumers is overwhelmingly Kentucky Wonder Brown. So I think 90% of the supermarkets who have any type of string bean, it's one type of string bean. Meanwhile, I think there's about 4,200 types of beans available. So it's this really narrow view of food and choice. And I don't think people are really aware of it. When I say I grow 350 varieties, people say, I didn't even know there were that many. And I said, well, that's nothing compared to what there actually is. So provenance really refers to, if you were to grow Kentucky Wonder Brown in the Pacific Northwest versus the South versus Maine or Mexico, it's going to exhibit different characteristics. And I've done this with a tomato called black cherry. I got black cherry tomato from about 5 different places, one of them being overseas. There was slight characteristic differences. Maybe the plant was a little smaller if it was from the Northwest. Maybe it was a little darker if it was from overseas. So there's small differences, and not every black cherry tomato is the same. They're generally speaking the same. It's really kind of interesting how plants begin to adapt to that particular geography. That's the thrust of the diversity, and I think it's very important to really see it save seeds regionally for seeds that are regionally adapted for your particular place, because not everything that's going to grow is going to grow well where you are.
So is that part of this, of your mission, maybe, to create varieties that are adapted to this particular, the North Fork? Or?
So we're increasing seeds. Not only we isolate the seeds for the heirlooms, because they have, in order for them to remain heirlooms, they have to be isolated and true to type for here. Then I kind of have either breeding projects that I'm looking for something specifically, and I'll keep breeding it for this place, or I'll do a mass cross and see what comes out of that. 8 different varieties and let them intersperse. And there's a story that that someone told me about this Long Island cheese pumpkin. And every farmer used to save their own seeds for this Long Island cheese pumpkin. And every single farmer, based upon what they were selecting, they had slight variations. Maybe their pumpkin was a little bit rounder, or theirs, you know, the one from 30 miles away was a little bit flatter. So they were all selecting for their own. It was the same pumpkin, but they were variations according to farm, which does not occur now because everybody's buying seeds from major seed corporations, and they're all uniform, and they're all the same, and they're all hybrids.
What are you thinking of? What is your view of the way the future is going to be in terms of what characteristics these plants need to adapt to?
I think plants, we have not really done enough in terms of seed saving on a big scale without corporate help. And I think, you know, we're having more extreme weather patterns. We have hurricanes earlier. We had one of the worst droughts. You know, we are not breeding plants for adaptability. We're breeding them for early, you know, when you're breeding a hybrid, you're breeding it for, you know, quickness to bring to market, earliness, and that they all get ripe at the same time, and they're all ready at the same time. But that's not very adaptable. You want a plant that if a hurricane blows through and it's not ready, it's going to be able to withstand that kind of punishment. Or if we have a drought, it's going to be able to withstand a drought. I have an entire, like, maybe 600 feet row that I'm dry farming this year for tomatoes. And what that means is they're not irrigated at all. And the same thing with all the corn varieties I have, because I'm trying to breed corn and tomatoes that are drought resistant. So the ones that die, they're just going to fall out of the gene pool. And the ones that do really well, those are the seeds I'm going to save, because they can withstand not having a terrible amount of water. So that's really, I think, where the thrust of this should be going.
So that's sort of diversity for survival, if you will.
Correct.
But then there's also diversity for palate, maybe.
Absolutely.
So can you talk about that?
Out of the tomatoes that I have out there, there was one that's called Brandywine Cherry. It's a very small cherry tomato that's supposed to be like a Brandywine. I find it to be fairly tart. Not every tomato that I have is going to taste good. I have wild tomatoes from Guatemala that taste terrible. But the thing is that I'm saving it because at some point it's going to be bred with something else. And every single plant, even if it doesn't taste good, is going to have some trait that's going to be useful for its future.
In another constellation of traits.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I find even, you know, a lot of people say, well, why heirlooms? And I have this happen to me at the market all the time, where people will, I say, well, try a string bean. They're, you know, just try a string bean. So this woman came up to me last week and she said, I haven't had a string bean like this since I was a child in Tennessee and I picked it out of my grandmother's garden. And that means something to me. And when people taste heirloom vegetables or open pollinated vegetables, you taste a difference because they're just more genetically robust.
What about time? I mean, how are you just incredibly busy all the time?
Yes, unfortunately. I think.
And do you work by yourself? You don't have other people working with you
No.
in a formal sense?
No. I think it's very difficult to do this. And as I get bigger, of course, you need to add staff. I've been doing this pretty much myself. I think, you know, certain things you can allow other people to do, whether it's harvesting, as long as you know, give them good instructions. But this is so specific and takes time to learn this. It's terribly time consuming. I mean, you're talking like 16, 18 hour days just to do this. And 2 acres for doing this is fairly small.
I'm sort of sorting out how important the growing and the collecting and the seeds and the pollinating, all that stuff is, mm-hmm. as opposed to just selling the vegetables for money, for income.
Well, I mean, I think that's very interesting. I really don't know of anybody else who's doing what I'm doing here. But that's also a drawback, because when you go to the farmer's market and you see everybody who has the same beets, the same squash, the same everything, well, then it just becomes a question of who is selling it cheaper. I mean, if every farmer was selling different things, that, you know, Farmer Joe had something that Farmer Brenda didn't, then you create a market. But if everybody's growing the same thing, that becomes, a relatively futile exercise, I find.
Then it's just different from the supermarket. That's the only point of difference.
Well, probably. I mean, not exactly. I mean, supermarkets are industrial agriculture, where a farmer's market or a farm stand is really local. You know where you're getting it from. It's not terribly, it may be conventional, but it's not terribly industrialized. But I still find people want a choice. I mean, when people say, I've never seen a squash like that, or that can't possibly be a tomato, that's where the education comes in about diversity and why we need diversity.
But then it also means you have to work with other farmers. So how do you work with other farmers? I mean, you're basically saying to other farmers, grow some of my seeds so you can have different products from your farmer neighbor.
We started, this year was a test case for the Long Island Seed Consortia, which we started. And farmers are notoriously independent. It's very difficult to get people on the same page. But we were able to have a small test case of farmers this year, 6 different farms, to try these regionally adapted seeds, grow them out, see how they behave, and then get back together at the end of the year and really start a regional seed bank for farmers. But like I said, this year was really small. It was a test case, because sometimes you say, well, we're going to grow eggplant, and 2 farmers say, well, I don't grow eggplant. That's it. But I think you really have to have a cooperative spirit in order to do something like this. And that's really the plan, is because I really don't want to be the only person saving seeds, propagating seeds. I think it's really incumbent upon all of us to increase the diversity in general.
Each on a farm by farm basis,
yes.
As well.
Yes.
I see. So just talk about pricing a little bit. I'm assuming that everything you take to market is more expensive.
It is slightly more expensive, but it's more expensive just because of the research and the saving aspect of it. But there's no point in me trying to sell something that only the very wealthy can afford. That's like anathema to the project. But by the same token, I can't charge 99 cents a pound for everything that I sell.
It's an anathematical project because it fights the idea of diversity.
Exactly.
Only 1%
exactly.
of buying it.
You need the 99% also rowing the boat with you. And that's the point.
Which brings me to the Farmer's Pledge, mm-hmm. that's on your website. Talk about your website. If people do want, by the way, to get in touch with you or find out more about you.
Yes. The website, unfortunately, has not been updated in about a month and a half, just because I haven't had time. But you can go to my Facebook page, and we regularly post updates on there, too.
And that is?
Invincible Summer Farms on Facebook.
Invincible Summer Farms.
The point of the Farmer's Pledge is basically it's an outcropping of NOFA New York, Northeast Organic Farmers Association.
Oh.
It's basically an outcropping of being certified organic. I am not certified organic, though I do follow those practices. I don't spray pesticides. And basically, it outlines that in the Farmer's Pledge. You know, you're going to try to have be transparent, have sustainable agriculture. And people in NOFA, pretty much everybody signs that Farmer's Pledge, even if they're not certified, even if they haven't gone through the certification.
Does that mean you will one day go through that process? Or?
You know, I'm very transparent when it comes to my customers, restaurants, the general public.
Farmers markets.
Yeah. I have a CSA. I'm kind of on the fence about going certified organic. Because my practices are basically organic. For me, with all the other things I have to do to go through the process and all the paperwork, and to me, it just seems very time intensive.
And you wouldn't be doing anything very differently anyway.
I wouldn't be doing anything differently except just going through mountains of paperwork, right, and being inspected. So
that's what the Farmer's Pledge is about?
That you are going to follow sustainable agricultural principles.
And yet your personal mission is also this idea of relating community and food.
Right.
And knowing where your food comes from.
I take every opportunity I can to talk to the people who are interested in my vegetables, not only about the food and how I sell the food and how I grow the food, but what connection that has, whatever kind of story that comes with it. There, it may have a background, it may have a history. the comment you made about your mother's the nasturtium seeds.
Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. Like, I've never heard of that before, and that's one of those things where people say, I remember doing this or having this as a kid, but it's a loss now. So I find, like, when I have these conversations with people, then things get really interesting, and it ties them to that kind of food. It's not, I'm going to the, you know, A&P and I'm picking up lettuce. It's that, you know, Grandma Dottie grew this lettuce in Pennsylvania, and I have a connection to it.
It's knowing where your food comes from also, right, in the sense of literally where it was grown,
right,
how it was produced, not just what its history is. I often wonder whether when people say around here, and this is such an agricultural area, it says the food is local. I don't know what that means. And I always ask, where did this come from? Did you grow this? What should a person do if they want to really know where the food comes from?
I've always said that it is well known among farmers and probably not among consumers. Somebody else asked me that question. Well, what does local mean? And I said, well, local means not mine. Local means that I didn't grow it.
Oh, it's a euphemism.
It's a euphemism. And it's the same thing for homegrown. A way of getting around. There's a lack of education because everybody wants everything, and it doesn't necessarily matter if it's in season. So if a farm stand has asparagus in July or apples in June, there's a problem. A consumer is not going to say, wait a second, that's not in season. How do you have asparagus in July, or why do you have apples now? The consumer doesn't really think twice about it. It just says, oh, I'm at a farm stand. There's a farm here. It must be theirs. And it's a way of leading the consumer down the primrose path. Not that I think there's anything wrong with reselling it, but I think if we really want people to be rooted to farms and farmers, we have to say, I got this from X, Y, and Z, and it's not actually growing now. And I think part of it is just educating the consumer.
Because I sometimes feel as if I'm being a bit aggressive and antagonistic when I say, well, where's this from? Did you grow it? It's sort of, and they, I feel, sometimes get defensive.
I prefer those kinds of questions. And if you have a transparent grower, if you have a good farmer, there are plenty of farmers I know who resell stuff and they say, yeah, you know, I got this down the road, or it's not mine, or I got this from wherever. And then there are people who aren't. But I find the majority of farmers are pretty much on the up and up. There's a few shady people out there, but farmers, we do this because we love to do it. We're not getting rich. We do it because we believe in it and we love it. So we want to have that kind of conversation about selling practices and about growing practices.
It's really been incredibly interesting to learn what's going on in these 2 acres off Young's Avenue, if anybody is in the area in Southold. And I look forward to seeing your vegetables at the farmer's market,
yes,
in Greenport. Every weekend in Greenport? Or
yes, it's the Greenport Farmer's Market starting in August.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Steph.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
North Fork Works and Hazel Kahn. You've been listening to Stephanie Gaylor, a farmer from Southold on the North Fork of Long Island who specializes in heirloom seeds and plants. This is WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming and archived on WPKN.org. North Fork Works, produced by Tony Ernst, is heard on the first Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. right after Free Speech Radio News. Program podcasts are available on hazelkahn.com and on iTunes.